Experimental Schools. The University of Iowa, and its experimental schools from which I graduated in 1952, have influenced nearly the whole of my life in one way or another. My mother and father were graduates of the university. My father, Wendell Johnson, spent his entire professional life there. After his death in 1965, my mother continued living in the family home in Iowa City until her death in 1989. My sister, Kate, is also a UI graduate, 1956. I returned to Iowa City in 1981 and taught in its College of Law until retiring in 2014. I was literally born on the University of Iowa campus, in the University Hospital. By the age of 2, I was enrolled in the university's preschool, the Iowa Child Welfare Research Station. Next to my parents, there has probably been no greater influence on my life than university elementary and high school. During our graduation from UHI, we embodied our energy in a musical extravaganza we presented as a farewell. Classmate Joe Howe was the principal author and producer of this production. He went on to become a lawyer, law professor, and judge before retiring. Another classmate, Dick D. Gowan, who earned his MD degree and a position on the IE's College of Medicine faculty, found a copy of that script for a show we called Real George. It was hard to keep up with my classmates. Many were with me from preschool until we graduated from UHI. One fellow, whose name was Howard Berg, was so smart, he used to play with toys in elementary school that I would later read in Scientific American hadn't even been invented until 10 years later. He was reputed to have received the highest score in the state of Iowa on a test that won him a Pepsi Cola scholarship. And it was in that spirit that this show was put together. It looked at the future. And as I reread that script, I discovered that we had predicted in 1952 the following: travel to the moon, rampant inflation, a renewed interest in clairvoyance and astrology, electronic music, parodies of TV commercials, teaching machines, and even resistance by the United States Senate to a growing investment in militarism, including an investigation of a new weapons system, very much like the AB, that had cost the American people $28 billion. But perhaps of greatest relevance to that 1952 graduation is our prediction in 20 years there would be a very important gathering of UHI alumni. And that on that occasion someone would be coming back to Iowa City from Washington. No one predicted, or even imagined, least of all me, that I would be that person. The investment that the University of Iowa made in its experimental schools was not much, certainly not in terms of programs in Washington. The 57-year total outlay was about $6 million. Nor did the school require much land or many buildings. First housed in a small building on the Pentcrest, in the 1920s the school occupied what is now called North Hall. The schools never had an auditorium. The last commencement before it closed had to be held in the university's McBride Hall. Dr. Ernest Horn, who came to Iowa City from Columbia University's Teachers College, established the schools in 1916. Many administrators and teachers supported the idea in the years since, so this essay is limited to those during my time there. Dr. Virgil Hanger was then the president of the university. His daughter, Mary Sue, was a member of our class. Dr. Peterson was dean of the College of Education. Dr. Vernon Van Dyke's term as director almost exactly paralleled my own from 1941 to 1952. Dr. Herbert Spitzer was a grade school principal who appeared to me at the time as at least 11 feet tall. The high school principals we seemed to drive through the school with a little greater regularity than elementary school were Drs. Murray Martin, Myron Olson, John McAdam and Dwight Davis. They shared the idea of UHI and were responsible for it in ways none of us really knew, understood or appreciated as fully as the faculty with whom we spent our time. Grade school teachers are like surrogate mothers who deserve a special place in our educational hall of fame. They either get us off to a good start or mess up our education forever. We should be forever grateful for their love and skill that made it possible for us to enjoy school. Many of the high school teachers who helped me were there a relatively short time. Some who were around longer had a positive and lasting effect on whole families. Giants like Drs. Lewis Alley, M.F. Carpenter, John Hefner, Camille Lebois, Vernon Price, and many more. During one period of about 20 years, there were some 200 PhD singles who spent time on the staff at UHI. I have no idea how many student teachers have passed through the school. But about the time our class graduated, we had interacted with about as many student teachers as we had students. The only way to think in terms of the impact of an institution like this is in terms of the people whose lives it has affected, and the ripples it produces throughout the rest of society. There are hundreds of former UHI staff, students, and student teachers, who are today university presidents and deans of schools of education, professors and teachers, and officials of educational institutions and associations. The effect of UHI has been felt not only through people, but also in terms of the teaching materials and new teaching methods and texts that have been evolved here. Indeed, I think it's somewhat ironic that UHI really began at the behest of the president of the university, Walter Jessup, because of the difficulty he was running into with educational experiments in the public schools. They wouldn't let him do it the way he wanted. His reaction was very much like that of Howard Hughes. Billionaire Hughes was staying in a Las Vegas hotel where he didn't like the service. His response? He bought the hotel. That's kind of what President Jessup did, as Emil Trotri calls it, who was one of UHI's first students. He said, "If that's the way you fellows are going to be, all right, I'll just start my own school." And he did. Because what President Jessup realized, as everyone who has dealt with bureaucratic institutions knows, whether the military, school systems, corporations, government agencies, or a television network, is that it's not really a place where genuine creativity and intellectual activity can take place. Some people hired to execute a mission they don't control may be superb at what they do, but they don't have the time, talent, or temperament to think about and challenge the basic assumptions of their institution. For that, a separate group of individuals must be created. For our public schools, those individuals are the ones who do research in experimental schools. The University of Iowa pioneered in the field of academic testing, using those of us in the experimental schools as the guinea pigs to evaluate and improve those tests. The Iowa tests of educational development were used throughout the state of Iowa and elsewhere. Iowa City is now headquarters for commercial testing service companies. Speed reading enjoyed a boom nationally in the late 1950s and early 60s. It was first tried out on us by Dr. Jim Stroud in the 1940s. It's unlikely such a radical experiment would be approved by any school board in the nation at that time. Nor were Iowa's parents easily persuaded, Jim found out, as he traveled the state trying to sell the program elsewhere. They complained students wouldn't understand the material they read. In his best tweed sport coat with elbow patches, Mark Twain mustache, and Missouri drawl, he'd take a puff on his pipe and explain, "If it now takes your child 2 hours to make it through the evening's homework reading assignment, and he or she doesn't understand it, and I can teach them how to read it in 1 hour, and they still don't understand it, I figure I've done them a favor." It was the staff of UHI that developed comprehensive curriculum guides in the late 1930s and 1940s that could not be developed within the Iowa public school system, guides still valued by teachers in and out of the state years later. The concept of interdisciplinary team teaching was evolving in the 1920s and 1930s at UHI some 20 years before it became widespread throughout the nation. The work of Dr. Ralph Fitchman in giving junior high school students an awareness of basic psychology was carried out at UHI in the 1940s. The list goes on and on and on: foreign language teaching in grade school, techniques in music instruction, research in physical education, new curricula for teaching the sciences, Ernest Horn's innovation in teaching spelling to grade school pupils, Dr. Carpenter's approach to teaching high school English, and Dr. Price's geometry students writing their own textbook. There's more, but that should make the point. The accepted methods of teaching today all had to begin at some time and in some place. As often as not, when you track it back, the place was UHI, and the time was about 20 years before public schools decided the ideas were safe enough to try. The trouble with UHI was that it was all done naturally and relatively quietly. UHI has never had an office of public information, it never hired a public relations firm, no principal ever called a press conference. As often happens, what the permanent staff of UHI had their concern, commitment, excitement and adventure about life and education was passed on to us, the student teachers and junior staff. Kozel describes in his book Death at an Early Age how some public schools almost sadistically drive any creativity and curiosity and sense of individual worth and development out of their wards. My wife, Karen, who attended the university schools with me for 9 years, has told me similar stories over the years about things she has witnessed in public schools where she taught in Virginia, California, Texas, and the District of Columbia. My own experience is limited to that of a parent. But I must say it has often left me in a state of despair about the quality of education offered my own children by public schools that often brag of their national superiority. As I know from my term as a school board member, there are many public school teachers who are committed, competent and concerned many more than are ever recognized, thanked or adequately compensated. But many to most feel the oppression of a bureaucratic system. The best merely do what they are told to do, rather than feeling a part of an exciting adventure at the frontiers of educational innovation. Whatever the public schools may be, they are not that. All teachers at some point in their career, and for however short a time, ought to have the opportunity to be exposed to such a faculty and student body. Somewhere, in the $70 billion, barnacle-encrusted, bureaucratic industry that goes by the name of education, somewhere in amongst the concrete buildings and the computers and the layers of administrators, somebody better be watching to make sure that the torch of learning has not gone out entirely. If that is not to be the University of Iowa, so be it. We certainly have lots of company. Lab schools are closed all over the land. It's now a politically acceptable way to save money and cut taxes. But as anybody knows who has tried to keep a campfire going all night without a match, you can start it up again by blowing on one red-hot coal, but once you are left with nothing but ashes, you're just going to be blowing dirt into your face and the darkness. Lab schools, experimental research schools, may not be able to single-handedly reform public education, but they sure could help. ouououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououououou life inside an experimental school during the 1940s. Much of the rest of it, though not the stuff of a conventional memoir, is revealing of my life and thinking while serving on the FCC, thinking ultimately taking the form of the book, Test Pattern for Living. Those excerpts follow. This afternoon, Tommy Smothers called me and tracked me down at Mother's house. He was about to leave for France to watch and film his brother, Dickie, in the auto races at Le Mans, and he wanted to know what I was doing. I said I was writing a commencement address for my high school. And he said, "Well, you know, I really think you owe them the opportunity, the option, to back out." And I said, "Why, Tommy, why is that?" And he then reminded me of my record, in terms of association with public performances. He went through it all. The time he car into Washington to talk to me, and then went back to Hollywood and found out his show had been cancelled. And then the last time I went on Dick Cavett's show, and the rumors now going around that it's going to be cancelled. The last time I was on the Merv Griffin show, a couple weeks later CBS cancelled his contract and put him into syndication. And Tommy reminded me it was about that point I got out of the television business entirely and went into the theater, the Broadway theater. I became the technical advisor to a Broadway play called The Selling of the President. It's a delightful musical, I thought, a version of Joe McGinnis' famous book. And it's about the impact of television commercials on politics. Well, I say it was a Broadway play, but while it did open on Broadway, but the next morning it closed. I'm pleased and flattered to be invited back here to do my act. But you can understand why I'd be a little concerned that I may wake up tomorrow morning to read in the paper that somebody's closed the school. ../. The fundamental problem, of course, as you will soon discover, is that there is a basic conflict between the values of genuine education that you have been provided at university high school and the values of the corporate state into which you are now or in a few years going to move. School is where you learn about freedom and democratic or popular control. It's the last time you'll hear it mentioned, let alone practiced. Learning gives you a sense of your unique, individual worth. But your value to the economy as a consumer and employee is not as an individual, but as a predictable piece in a mass merchandised economy as a consumer, and as a reliable machine in an industrial state as an employee. As your education progresses, you are given more and more choice and control over selecting your own activities and goals. This is called maturity. Once you graduate, however, you are expected merely to execute predefined goals under the close direction of others. You have virtually no control or choice over what you produce, how you produce it, or what it's used for. Teachers encourage you to challenge assumptions, to ask basic questions. Employers, you will find, fire you when you do. Paul Goodman has described your dilemma under the descriptive title, Growing Up Absurd. If you haven't read it, you might enjoy it. Two alternatives are basically available, neither of which do I find very acceptable. One is to simply drop out. John Prine has a delightful little song in which he puts that bit of advice with the line, Blow up your TV, which always delighted me for a starter. Blow up your TV, throw away your paper, move to the country and build you a home. Well, that's not necessarily bad advice, but neither is it going to solve the problem, because for most of us it's not very practical. Another solution is to try to modify the educational system. As Kozil and my wife will tell you, that now appears to be the most widely accepted solution. If we could only train young people in school to really like Barbie dolls, motel decor, neon signs along suburban highway shopping centers, television programs, Detroit cars, hairspray, and Coca-Cola, then they won't be so frustrated when they get out. I saw a film the other day about how they do it in South Africa, the way in which they sustain apartheid. Essential to the life and economy of that nation is the enforced ignorance of its blacks. They are simply not permitted to see the swimming pools, tennis courts and schools, their labor, and misery, support. No, I don't think the answer lies in seeing to it that no one in our society, students or student teachers, ever experience what a subculture of truly dedicated free minds and educational researchers might look like. I don't think keeping people from that vision is going to solve the problem. I think they should be given that spark, that vision, that dream, against which to measure their daily lives. John Gardner, whose two books, Excellence and Self-Renewal, may very well be among the most important of the 20th century, has said that a nation that does not value excellence in its plumbers as well as its philosophers will find that neither its pipes nor its theories hold water. No, I believe it is work that must change, not quality education. The workplace is today, as it was at the time when Louis Brandeis described it, the place where we have the greatest abridgment of citizens' rights. Workers and consumers, you and I, simply must be permitted to exercise greater control over the products as well as the means of production. And gradually, in some places in this country and others, that principle is being extended. Because a democracy simply cannot survive when it forces mature people to spend their lives dying in their jobs. We cannot give people the right to grow, and question, exercise discretion, and control their activities for only the 12 years of their lives that they are in school, and that only if they are lucky. A citizen cannot be repressed and treated as a machine subject to authoritarian control 8 hours a day all year long, and then suddenly perform as a mature person of judgment for 8 minutes every 4 years when he or she enters the polling booth. Well, that's the challenge that confronts you, how to put the UI idea into practice, to live your life in ways that argue more eloquently than words or buildings that those who preceded you as staff and as students were right to have invested in UI what they have.